for children of abuse and those who have suffered the cruelties of abuse, specifically sexual in nature. Maxine Hanks also has a distinguished background and career. I might mention that this session is sponsored by Signature Books. But Maxine is a writer and editor, and she has co-authored 4 books and authored many articles and essays and poems. She has been published ever since 1975, and she's included in her work since 1980 things that she's done at BYU, editing the work of Arthur King Henry. She's edited many manuscripts and various works for publishers at the U of U and then also at Signature. Indicated that she was born to work with words and to help those that are writing and presenting issues and topics, to help them express their thoughts better and make the impact of their work even more meaningful than what it was originally intended to be. She enjoys editing out into the mainstream for us to enjoy. She's edited everything from BYU professors to heretics to feminists to patriarchs. And she enjoys editing them all. She also assisted Maureen in the editing of the work Riptide. But without any further ado, I think we'll be honored and pleased to have these two wonderful ladies with us today and present this session. And I might mention that if you do have a question, please, if you don't want to make it up here to the mic, if we would have it restated into the microphone or make it audible so we can all hear for our glorious tape, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, for those that like to crash the Sunstone symposiums and don't have their little official name tag, if you fall in that category, I would hope that guilt would cause you to go out and visit with our folks at registration and get the appropriate identification. And that would be a wonderful thing if you could be in compliance with that request from the Sunstone Board and from Albert. But at any rate, we're pleased to have you here this morning.
I began working in the area of child sexual abuse when it was first emerging as a legal and therapeutic specialty in 1980. At that time, I was the first director of ISAT, and I should say I'm not on the board of ISAT anymore, but that's okay. Who cares? Anyway, of the ISAT Treatment Center here in Salt Lake City. During our first year at ISAT, we anticipated a caseload of 80 clients. In fact, we treated 480. We soon established branch offices around the state. Child sexual abuse was a booming field, bursting at the seams. Many agencies, such as Family Support Center, Children's Justice Center, Primary Hospital, Valley Mental Health, Children's Center, Rape Crisis Center, and others, now serve victims of child abuse in the state of Utah. Our policy at ISAP from the beginning was that sexual abuse was an event that impacted the entire family and that every person in a family, particularly in incest cases, but also in cases of extrafamilial abuse, needed treatment individually and conjointly. Our policy was to assign the primary case manager to the child victim, but also to provide therapy for the perpetrator, non-offending spouse, and siblings, in the form of individual treatment, dyads, and family therapy when and if it seemed appropriate. Working in this model, I landed up treating a lot of moms as well as children, and I became very aware of the devastation of abuse on the entire family and on extended families. I also saw a lot of adults who were abused as children, and again, the effect of their abuse on their family of origin, their present spouse, if they had one, and children, as well as upon themselves, was very real and tragic. One of my purposes in writing Riptide was to show the devastation of child abuse on the extended family and others, as well as upon the direct victim. In the past 25 years, beginning with Louise Armstrong's early feminist autobiography, Kiss Daddy Goodnight, a number of female authors have written brilliant fiction in which sexual abuse is a major theme. To mention just a few, Margaret Atwood, Dorothy Allison, Maya Angelou, and Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Sandra Cisneros, Alice McDermott, Jane Hamilton, Jane Smiley, and Lee Smith come to mind. This is not to say major male fiction writers have not also been dealing with this theme, but somehow the women authors seem to, in general, be more intensely personal about it. I know of scarcely any novels, however, which have dealt with the subject primarily through the eyes of another family member. Riptide portrays child abuse almost entirely from the point of view of a mother and grandmother of abused children. I wanted to show the amplitude of child abuse on people surrounding the child victim, and by inference, on a wider society. So the protagonist in the book is a grandmother in her 60s who is an active Mormon and a respectable, nice person. When I was working at ISAT and later in my community involvement in the area of child sexual abuse, it became immediately apparent how critical the attitude of LDS leaders, particularly the bishop, was in the healing process of faithful LDS members. I worked with bishops who were incredibly patient, giving, empathic, and indeed who literally saved the lives of some of my clients. I encountered others whose attitudes and actions were hostile and destructive. They had no idea of the betrayal my clients experienced, who almost all felt that God had let this happen to them, and then that the church had abandoned, or worse, condemned them. So another idea I wish to reveal in Riptide is the sometime inaction and denial of child abuse by institutions in our society, particularly those of church and law enforcement. From all available data, child abuse within the LDS community appears to be statistically equivalent to that across the country. No better, no worse. Furthermore, the best estimates of the rates of abuse has remained pretty consistent for the last 15 years. According to the Boy Scouts of America, the National Association for the Prevention of Child Abuse, and other resources, one in four girls and one in six boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. To make this statistic a little more visual, think of a bench in any ward on any Sunday morning with 12 members sitting on it. This means that four of these people will be sexual abuse victims statistically, and one will be a perpetrator. This figure does not specify how serious the abuse may have been, but it is consistent with research with adults who now anonymously report a similar rate of abuse occurring in their childhoods a generation ago. So the question of whether abuse is increasing is not particularly borne out in the surveys of adults at the present time. Certainly the LDS Church cannot be held responsible for the individual actions of its members. The disturbing thing is that covers-ups and denial continue to occur, and that children are not protected from predators within church settings as well as they might be. Here are a few examples of leads from the Salt Lake Tribune within the last 6 months. Former Boy Scout official found guilty of molesting foster child. Fairview Seminary teacher charged with sexual child abuse. LDS Church to settle sexual abuse lawsuit. Scoutmaster who tried to brand victims as liars receives light sentence. LDS counselor guilty of molesting girls, and so on. A case that almost parallels the one I used in Riptide was reported last spring involving a former scoutmaster and brother of a stake president in Logan. The Salt Lake Tribune reported that a certain Jay Toombs was charged with three felony charges and that there had been calls and allegations from parents and alleged victims dating back more than 20 years. Detective Rod Peterson is reported as saying, "They've forgiven him. They believe that he's repented." A mother had reported Toombs' abuse to two LDS bishops and Toombs' family, including his brother, the state president. Here is a chilling quote from the mother of a victim in the article. "I was always told to be patient with Jay. He was a good man. That's what I was told again and again and again. I was even given priesthood blessings that I had been chosen to help him." The article goes on to say the bishop wanted to report the abuse but deferred because church officials said Toombs was repentant and getting professional help. Abuse continued for at least 10 years. As in my novel, this was a clear case of joint inaction by church and law enforcement, which can happen especially in a small community when the personnel of law enforcement and ecclesiastic officers is apt to be intermixed. If prominent so-called righteous persons are accused, then many pressures are brought to bear. The party line may become, "It's not that bad. He's a good person." I should say she is a good person. "Just a little mixed up. Think of what this will do to the family and to the ward." In response to this case, Rob Parrish of the Utah Attorney General's Office is reported as saying, "Few children, clergy included, realize that pedophiles have deep-seated problems that need long intensive counseling with the threat of prosecution or jail hanging over them in order to change, and even then the prognosis isn't very good." In the same Logan area, a convicted child molester was recommended by a state president for a mission after serving his sentence until the victim's father raised such a fuss that the call was withdrawn. In Sandy last May, a bishop was arrested and prosecuted for failure to report the abuse of a girl in his ward until her seminary teacher intervened with him and threatened exposure if the bishop would not report. Such courage on the part of the seminary teacher seems uniquely commendable. Just yesterday, an article in the Tribune addressed the question of clergy confidentiality in child sexual abuse cases. It stated two bishops are now facing criminal charges in Salt Lake County for allegedly failing to report suspected child sexual abuse. David McConkie, legal counsel for the church, commented in the article that the LDS clergy is unpaid, which makes mandatory training sessions on child sexual abuse difficult to impose in a voluntary organization. This response seems patently unreal to someone who has grown up in the church system and knows how effective training can be, training or instruction. Such cases, when legally mandated, go on. But my point is that a strong commitment to report abuse on the part of church leadership could reduce these cases considerably. Sometimes church leaders behave as if failure to report is not in violation of the law. The church has been sued in a number of civil cases around the country, the largest of these being the $700 million case in West Virginia, which was settled last spring with no terms revealed and a gag order imposed so no participants could discuss settlement terms. Large cases have occurred in Texas, California, Washington, and Idaho. A $4 million Texas case was settled last year. In a Salt Lake Tribune feature article written by Peggy Stack last fall on sex abuse within the LDS Church, a church spokesman acknowledged there had been 40 civil suits and others quietly settled with the victims' families. Most of these settlements imposed gag orders, which means the plaintiff agrees not to reveal the terms of the case after it is privately settled. Some attorneys and child advocates are saying such gag orders may be unconstitutional, but this has yet to be tested. I deplore their use because the public is then kept in the dark about what is really going on, and the victim is made to feel guilty in the sense that the secret must continue to be kept, which is a dynamic of all sexual abuse, so in a sense, gag orders re-victimize the victim. Mandatory reporting laws regarding child sexual abuse began to be made from the late 70s on. In Utah, a self-report of a confessional nature made to a bishop or priest does not have to be reported, but all other allegations from any other source must be reported, including disclosures other family members may make to the bishop. If the church really wants this legal mandate enforced, they should be able to get a rule out to the bishops in a way that it will be effectively implemented. Historically, many churches have tried to keep acts of officers or members internal to the organization, believing they can protect the offender and the family and work through the repentance process, or else they have wanted to protect the image of their church or the church from legal prosecution. The LDS Church has had to deal with similar issues. Dealing with sexual abuse and acknowledging its occurrence has greatly improved in the last 10 years in the church, in my opinion, but more needs to happen. The helpline, instituted in about 1989, is for church officials only, not for individuals, and many therapists I've talked with say it is ineffective and designed primarily to protect the church legally. In fall of 1995, the Catholic Church petitioned the Supreme Court of Texas to hold that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, guaranteeing freedom of religion, requires that the church be granted immunity against any civil suit involving the sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests. The Catholic Church declares itself immune from all litigation and from discovery in cases involving Catholic priests, thus circumventing the normal appeals process by applying for premature relief from the Supreme Court. In December 1995, a friend of the court brief was submitted in support of the Catholic petition by nine other churches, including the LDS Church. These churches were denying any liability for abuse committed by clergy, even if the abuse had been reported to church hierarchy and continued to occur. Case law has hitherto consistently held churches responsible for such actions. A number of child advocate organizations filed their own amicus curiae brief in opposition to these claims. Their brief asserts that no religious belief is raised by the sexual abuse of children or church action related to such abuse, that issues involving negligent hiring and negligent supervision are secular claims which can be adjudicated without inquiry into religious doctrine and practice, and that a church body has a duty to act as a reasonably prudent person to avoid risk to children and to warn children and their families of known danger. To my knowledge, this petition has not yet been heard before the Supreme Court. I think it is very unfortunate that the LDS Church has taken the position on this issue which it has. Organized religions, including the Mormons, continue to seek redress from victims' claims through judicial and congressional action. What seems to be of paramount importance to victims is how the church responds to the victim's own report of abuse. While church counseling of victims has vastly improved, and it truly has, I know I sound like I'm angry about what the church is doing, because I am, but the improvement should not be underestimated neither. No overall training of leaders has occurred since 1996. I don't understand why this should not be conducted on an annual basis. In the Gerds-Beck study of attitudes of adult victims at BYU, published in Ophelia, the social work professional journal, the researchers found a preponderance of women molested as children who were then attending BYU were very reluctant to tell their bishops of their abuse because they felt that the bishop would either not believe them, tell them to forget it and get on with their lives, tell them they contributed in some way to their own abuse, or counsel them to forgive their abusers. The issue of church leaders counseling forgiveness is a major theme in my novel, which raises questions of what is forgiveness, how does it work, what does it mean? The main character in Riptide is consumed by these issues, which leads to some of the conflict in the book. I believe there are some concrete ways the church could improve its handling of child sexual abuse problems. First, educate church personnel about mandatory reporting, about putting the victim's interest first, about the important and unique contribution a leader can make in counseling whole families, and particularly adults who were molested as children. Second, remove gag orders from legal settlements. Third, screen people working with children in church settings. Maintain records on them and red flag those who should not have access to children. Fourth, let the help hotline be available to individuals, not just bishops and stake presidents, and have therapeutic advice take precedence over legal advice in these calls. Fifth, educate congregations about abuse, its prevalence, symptoms, and consequences. Speak openly about it, including warnings about situations found in Boy Scouts or recreational activities. And this may be a far-out suggestion when you think about it, and I would not make it were the prevalence not so high. If truly 25-30% of our children, boys and girls, are being abused, then it merits this kind of drastic address, in my opinion. Sixth, recognize the help adolescent perpetrators need and that they must be identified and receive professional treatment. Counseling by the bishop is not enough, nor should they be sent on missions. For the adolescent's sake, they need to be in the juvenile legal system in most cases. Seventh, drop the amicus briefs claiming First Amendment immunity to prosecution. Eighth, acknowledge what a big problem sexual and domestic abuse is in the church and stop the denial and secrecy so that children's needs are put ahead of those of the institutional church and its public image. Ninth, stop teaching the infallibility of leaders and that arbitrary obedience to patriarchal authority is always a good thing, so children may be more prepared to recognize sexual manipulations made in authoritarian guise. In Riptide, I also wanted to raise the question of what happens when primal emotion, anger, revenge, the dark emotions, override so-called civilized conditioned responses. Almost every mother I've known whose children have been abused, and almost every adult sexually abused as a child, has said to me, "I just want to kill him, her." So I wanted to follow the line of, okay, what happens if you do? Not only what happens to you externally, but what happens internally. And that's really what Riptide is about. Laurel, the protagonist in the book, knows she shares in moral guilt. In some way, she allowed, albeit unconsciously, her children and grandchildren to be abused. She cannot remain morally innocent any longer, as who in this past century can? Indeed, part of the cynicism we decry in our contemporary culture is simply a recognition that no one is morally innocent. Laurel, by her denial and enabling of the abuse in her own family, has taken responsibility for entering to some degree in the evil exemplified in the perpetrator. Laurel's husband, Duncan, will not accept this premise, which is part of the tension in the story, but by accepting it and grieving for it, Laurel has come to a new place. The question for Laurel is, once you recognize your responsibility and the guilt of inaction, what do you do about it? In her case, she acts violently to eradicate the evil. She murders the perpetrator in the first chapter. But a lot of the rest of her inner journey is an examination of this method. What are the implications if she accepts that you cannot adopt the methods of the so-called perpetrators of evil? As an aside, I don't think this is an abstract question today, but a pressing social one before us in the political and geopolitical arena, in business, in religious and other institutional life, and in family relationships. An obvious example would be the question of capital punishment. In any major trauma, I believe existential issues of evil and of death become insistent. Almost always there's the cycle we hear about of denial, guilt, anger, confrontation, grief, and acceptance. In any great loss, be it one of health, of a loved one, of a role identity, or a career, a betrayal by someone close to, or by what one perceives to be a betrayal of church or God. These are such basic universal themes, and they are certainly the stuff of literature, but I think almost everyone has to come to terms with them at some time. So Riptide is really Laurel's existential crisis over these issues. It is her cry of, why is this happening to me? What do I believe in? And her attempt to bring meaning to crisis. Laurel's resolution is tentative and ambiguous, but I hope that it is also provocative. In writing Riptide, I used a stream of consciousness style, and it is obvious to any reader that in its use I'm addressing many of my own issues, which is probably true in fiction far more than we are usually aware. As the protagonist, Laurel remembers and ponders in Riptide. She also imagines how scenes in her children's lives might have occurred. I'll read one of these scenes now to illustrate how her mind works. In this scene, Jasmine is Laurel's 7-year-old child. Catherine is her oldest daughter, engaged to Clint. This is Laurel's imagining of the past as she's driving to California and her wondering how repression and dissociation worked for her daughter, Jasmine. Jasmine's 7. Clint's trained her by now. He's dropped by our house to find Catherine on his way home from the university. Catherine isn't here. He says, "I'll watch Jasmine while I run to the store. I tell him I'll be back in half an hour." "How are you doing with your skateboard?" he asks Jasmine after I leave. He's wearing light brown cords and a navy sweatshirt. He's sitting on the family room sofa. "Not very good. I got my knee bloody." Jasmine's on the rug, brushing Hilda. She doesn't look at Clint. "I can probably make the wheels go slower. Where is it?" "In my room." "Let's go fix it." "You go. I'm doing Hilda." Her voice betrays nothing. She hides her face in Hilda's fur. "Jasmine, what did I tell you about minding? If I'm nice enough to fix your skateboard, the least you can do is help me. I might even have a piece of bubble gum." He's very big. He takes her little hand as they climb the stairs. He tells her he'll help her learn how to manage her skateboard, but his voice is whispery in the scary way. He's hurrying and pulls her. He closes the door to her room. "We don't have much time if I'm going to fix your skateboard. How's my little sweetheart?" He unbuttons her pants. He picks her up and puts her on the bed. Her body is limp. She doesn't say anything. She looks at the yellow flowers on the wallpaper. Soon, if she looks hard enough, they'll start to come out from the wallpaper. Then it'll be all right. She stares so hard, her eyes tear. The yellow flowers are bright and big as the sun. She blinks. She looks down at the little girl on the bed. She's older and bigger than the little girl on the bed from up in the corner by the ceiling. She doesn't care what happens to the little girl. The little girl looks like a cut-out wooden doll, a few inches thick, glued tight up to the yellow bedspread. The little girl isn't moving. The little girl has a light blue painted t-shirt with a painted face of a child with blonde ponytails. The mouth is smiling widely. Underneath the faces, big letters say, "Daddy's girl." She can read the letters from the corner of the ceiling because she knows what they say. Below the painted t-shirt are two brown legs glued to the bed in an upside down V. On one of the knees is a bloody scab. Long white fingers are tickling the little girl's tummy under her t-shirt. The little girl giggles. She hates the little girl. The little girl is stupid. She's ugly, too. She's bad and dumb. A voice is saying, "Such a pretty little girl. My little princess. Nobody else knows how pretty you are." She knows he's lying. The little girl is ugly. Everybody thinks so. The little girl likes him to tell her she's pretty. She's so dumb she'd believe anything. The voice says, "I'll bet you play our game real good today." The little girl's crying. "Cry, baby," she thinks. "Why don't you kick him? Why do you just lie there? I hate you." She imagines taking Daddy's long silver fire starter and touching it to the little girl. She wonders if she would go up in ashes like a newspaper crumpled in the fireplace. She can see his face, even though she's looking down from the ceiling. His face is big and red. There are hairs in little tiny holes on his chin. His eyes go back from his face into big circles. A red pimple by his nose has yellow on it. A drip of water is running down from the corner of his open mouth. She knows that the little girl thinks he smells like sour milk and cereal that's been sitting on the counter too long. If she were on the bed, she'd kick him. She'd get the big kitchen knife from the middle drawer and stick it in him. She'd make his heart be all bleedy. She'd make his mouth close so he could never make the sounds again. See, that didn't hurt. He's panting like he'd been playing tag at recess. The little girl hasn't moved. She's still nailed down. Tears run down her cheeks, but she doesn't make a noise. He shakes her if she makes any noise. He He's going out of the door of her bedroom. He has the skateboard. He'll make the wheels go slower. Heavenly Father's proud of how you're learning the lessons, he says as he closes the door. She knows how to stay on the ceiling longer than she used to. She can stay there until the little girl doesn't hurt so bad. She knows the little girl hurts worse on the inside than on the outside. She feels sorry for her now. She feels like crying. She wants to tell the little girl she can cry if she wants to. She wants to hand the little girl the big green bunny on the floor. The bunny's almost as big as the little girl. Daddy gave it to her last Easter. She wants to tell the little girl to be brave and tell him she doesn't want to play the games. But the little girl can't see or hear her. She can't do anything else now, so she disappears. The little girl lies quietly on her bed alone. And Clint, after he closes her door, he tries not to think what he's done. He's intent on the wheels of the skateboard. He looks at the wheels and says to himself, I've got to make this go slower. I promised Jasmine I'd fix them. Can't break promises to children. He's empty, drained. He knows something's happened, something he should think about, but he might stumble on the stairs if he did. He wonders if Jasmine loves him. She must. He does many nice things for her. Nobody appreciates him. Not Catherine, not Laurel or Duncan, not his own mother. She always bosses him, even now when he's 24. The only people he can boss are children. Children are special. They understand him. He can tell them what to do. They know he's strong and smart and powerful. That was how he used to think of his own mother. Still does if he's honest with himself. Her power over him bugs Catherine. He turns the small wrench on the nuts of the skateboard wheels. Jasmine must love him. He wants her to love him. After all, he loves Jasmine. Children give grown-ups something no one else can. All children, doesn't matter which. He likes all children. Catherine thinks that's one of his best qualities. There, the skateboard's fixed. Laurel should be back. He'll be on his way. Laurel and Duncan bother him sometimes. He wishes they took Catherine's temple marriage more seriously. It's only 6 weeks away now. Not that they aren't pleased about a temple marriage. They want all their kids to be married in the temple. They're after Jared now to go on a mission. But they don't appreciate how hard his mission was and how much temple marriage means to him. Laurel will have a glass of wine once a year. Does she tell the bishop? He wonders if she's worthy to go to the temple. She doesn't take it as seriously as he does. He's upset he didn't do better on his exam this morning. He prayed very hard to do well. Heavenly Father let him down. People are always letting him down. Sometimes he wouldn't care if most of the people he knows were dead. Children are better than adults. Jasmine, he calls up the stairs, I fixed it. She doesn't answer. He doesn't get many thanks in this house. They're too spoiled. He hears the garage door going up and a car motor stopping. Laurel opens the hall door. Thanks so much. I hope I wasn't gone too long. That's okay. I fixed Jasmine's skateboard for her. Oh, Clint, that's so nice of you. Who knows when Duncan would have gotten around to it. That's okay. Tell Duncan I'll pick up those new snow tires whenever he wants. He goes out the front door into the cold fall air. He wonders why he feels so tired and depressed. He'd like to go home and sleep. Nobody appreciates him. As he walks to his car, he's aware that tiny tears are coming from his eyes. He wipes his cheek with the back of his hand. He has no idea why he's crying. I need some sleep, he thinks, up too late studying. He glances at the cold, bare branches of the maple tree by the driveway. I hate fall, despairingly. Before he steps into his car, he kicks a Coke can in the gutter. He bends and picks up a small rock and slings it at the can. It hits dead on in the middle, but he feels no pride. He shrugs and gets in the car and slowly drives away. And I, sitting now in my car like any tourist driving to Palm Springs, if Clint's mother had been mine, who would I be now? A shudder quivers through my chest and shoulders, like a tremor from an earthquake aftershock. What do I really know of the interiors of his mind? Thank you.
It's been a privilege to know Marion Smith and work with her. I met her at an excommunication vigil where you meet the best people, I think. We had spoken on the phone and connected powerfully, although I didn't know why at the time, but I trusted that it meant something important. This was back in, 1993. We talked about our writing and what we were trying to do with it, and she was just starting to draft a fictional memoir. I felt compelled to talk with her about it. The past 7 years have flown by, and now that idea is a book entitled Riptide. Riptide is one of the most moving, engaging, deeply contemplative, brave, honest, beautiful narratives I have ever had the opportunity to read. In the life of a writer and editor, there's a lot of drudgery, working with texts that you don't particularly want to work with. But my opportunity to work on Marion's manuscript was just the opposite. Riptide was a sheer pleasure to read and work with, like its author, Marion Smith. Arresting phrases and vivid visuals flow out of her effortlessly, along with a myriad of literary, historical, and geographical references from her intensely passionate life of traveling, loving, giving, suffering, caring, creating. Marion sees and feels and knows so much of life. This is a woman who really knows how to live, and she has the rare ability to capture it all on a page. Such is a great writer. From the moment you begin reading Riptide, you enter the mind and body of Laurel Greer, and you don't want to leave. The inner world of Laurel's mind is a familiar place, yet a strange escape into another's troubled existence. Marion Smith has crafted Riptide as a stream of consciousness journey through the mind's landscape, as Laurel herself travels through Utah, trying to leave it and all of its traumas behind her. This is a smooth, easy narrative in the form of a memoir and confessional, yet set in fiction. The result is an authentic female voice in dialogue with herself and others. This narrative does not shy away from any topic or feeling, but takes us where a woman's mind really goes. I find this remarkable and powerful for a Mormon, because LDS writers tend to accentuate the positive. Even liberals, we liberals sometimes who engage the thorny problems, still tend to want to make everything turn out okay in the end. Marion Smith does not give in to easy solutions. She simply lets reality be exactly what it is, no matter how ugly or angry. She goes where life goes, and she deals with the way we really are, neither indulging in the darkness for the sake of controversy, nor indulging too much in hope for the sake of respectability. Marion stays with the way people really are all the way to the end of the book, and this is powerful writing. I want to mention just a few of her very skilled and beautiful literary devices. Her voice is very reflective and wry and sophisticated. The stream of consciousness is natural and engaging. Her pace and her conversational style in the book is very cutting edge and trendy and contemporary, which I find fascinating because Marion was in college in the 1940s and is writing as someone who is the same age as my mother. And I can't imagine my mother writing this book. Her use of metaphor all the way through is plentiful and unusual, inventive and skilled. Her allusions to literary and cultural images are abundant all the way through, from Sartre to Salman Rushdie. She uses juxtaposition and repetition. I especially love her use of repetition in the way that women are so naturally gifted to do, pausing and then repeating a word or a phrase over and over and over again to bring home the intensity of it. In fact, I'd like to read a couple of examples. Of repetition. Jeannie, Jeannie, Jeannie. Do every single thing I've ever known you to do. Or pull away, retreat, feel fury. Dear God, if you are there anywhere in any universe, please don't let it be Jeannie. Because if it is Jeannie, then the cry of every innocent falls upon a mother somewhere, and there can never be any meaning again. I implore, I beg, I command, but there is only silence stifling nothingness for the answer. No song, no touch, no remembrance of my swollen belly, No green, no caring for dead bird or dying planet if it is Jeannie. Not Jeannie, you hear me? Not Jeannie. No laughter to mock myself, no thorns, no crosses. No mangled minds or limbs, only nothing, nothing, nothing if it is Jeannie. If it is Jeannie. But it is. It is. It is. It's my Jeannie. Please, let it be me, not her. For the love of Christ, let it be me. Don't let it be Jeannie, because I will kill if it is Jeannie. Too often, editors want to remove the very peculiarities of an inventive or an honest writer, speaking the way people really talk. Sometimes editors want to change a woman's way of describing the world and remove repetition or alliteration or simile or odd juxtapositions in order to achieve some sort of straightforward, level, expository prose that flattens the voice right out into blandness. The work of an editor should be to preserve and clarify the uniqueness of a voice and a perspective. I want to talk about the few things, just a few of the things that I think are so significant about this book. The first is that it engages taboo, in other words, child abuse, child sexual abuse. It's a daunting task to broach the topic of child abuse in public. There's so little on this topic, and that's understandable. Recently, there's been a Tribune story, and before that, there was an article in the Arizona New Times a few years back, 6 years ago, and then Marianne's article in the Event magazine. Other than that, and the church pamphlet about preventing abuse, there really isn't much out there in the way of articles. I'll mention books in just a minute. There are just a few books dealing with child abuse. When Marianne's article in The Event came out in 1996, which she and Paul Swenson were very brave to publish, the negative response was intense. And yet still there were some people who thanked her for publishing the article. It's problematic to touch child abuse in public because of several reasons. The subject is dealing with negative sexual information and taboo sex, which is difficult to discuss in public without creating new concerns and problems. There's a question of propriety that hangs over any such discussion. Also, it's taboo to talk about sexual abuse in a religious community because of bad press and because of the religious nature of the community. Also, talking about child abuse raises problems of the kind of multi-layered interdependent fallout that happens when you start talking about abuse between individuals. And so if you bring it out, then you have the problem of the abusers potentially being exposed, privacy being exposed, and on and on and on. In spite of this, in spite of all of these dangers of broaching this topic in public, there are a few books that have come out. There was one in the early 90s, an anthology from Deseret Book, and I don't know the name of it. I think it was Confronting Abuse by Horton, but I think that's it. And then, of course, Paper Dolls by Carol Scott, which I think was 1991 or 92. Reach for the Rainbow by Lynn Finney in 1992, which was a personal story, again, a Mormon. And Father of Lives by Brian Evanson, and then now Riptide. So I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think 5 books that have dared to deal with this topic. We also have the Mormon Alliance case reports edited by Levina Fielding Anderson and Janice Allred. So that would make a 6th. Many brave and dedicated people have worked for decades to help victims of abuse. It's not easy bringing the darkness into light. Dealing with this topic and all of its damage is depressing at best and soul-deadening at worst. Those victims, parents, therapists, clergy, and families who journey through this dark night are shamans for our culture. Without strenuous pioneering emotional work, there would be no healing. I want to talk a little bit about the honesty, now that I've kind of covered the taboo aspect. Another really important aspect of this book that makes it groundbreaking in some ways is the way that it engages the negative side of being a woman in Mormon culture and talking about the darker side of culture and ourselves, and also talking about doubt and disbelief and the problem of evil. All of these things are engaged by Marion Smith in this book, which you don't see, again, a Mormon woman do very often in a text. Marion is a grandmother born and raised in Salt Lake, and yet her book takes us on a tour of the darker side of the Mormon female psyche, and the Mormon psyche as well. Riptide explores wrenching urges lurking inside of a woman's pain. The narrative follows her feelings of desperation, her attempts to resolve it, and her inner journey. It probes the moral dilemmas created by child abuse and its real effects on lives. Yet, unlike other abuse memoirs, this story gets inside the minds of several characters, not just the victim, but the parents, the mother, and even it gets inside the mind of the abuser, as in that passage Marion just read, where she goes from being in the mild mind of the child who is being abused and then moves to being inside the mind of the abuser himself, which is really stunning, I think, in this work. Also, this story is written in a very authentic female voice that confesses the darker side of Mormon culture as well as a woman's own darker nature. I want to read a couple more examples here, if I can find a couple. Just where she's kind of struggling with evil. C.S. Lewis says that God is a sculptor chiseling away at man to make him perfect. Only the hammering of suffering can make man reach out of his complacency toward God. Lewis should have stuck to his Narnia books. I'll never believe that evil exists to make us better, to test us. How can God sit there and say, Mrs. Jones could use a deformed baby right now? Or, Peru hasn't had an earthquake lately. I'd rather let violence be nature playing itself out. Maybe I could learn to accept suffering in the Eastern view, that everything contains its opposite, like Shiva's dance of birth and death, one creative process. Then I could learn how futile resistance is against the cosmic order, learn to go with the flow, that good and evil are two aspects of the same thing. Also, she shares angry feelings, dark emotions, disillusionment. There are some great moments in the book where she just really vents the kind of anger that a woman or a person who has suffered great abuse might feel. Those moments when you really want to get back at that person and just let them have it. And I want to read one of my favorite passages, really cathartic passages. Clint, I curse you dead and all your kind. I damn you to hell and back again. I scratch your vacant eyes and pull at your long fingers until they're useless, cracked, dangling globs of flesh and broken bones. I claw your weak, receding chin and pouting mouth. With all my force, I punch your fat, sagging belly. I trip your big feet and kick your ugly butt down flights of stairs with holy underwear hanging out above your brown trousers. I watch you fall in the mud and lie there, scarred and broken. I damn you to hell and back, where you can feel some fragment of our pain. Pretty cathartic. There aren't many books out there that I think really engage the shadow and the anger and the darkness and taboo, that really black anger sometimes, or even just the darker realities that lurk in our culture and inside of ourselves. But I was trying to think of a few that do, and of course the ones that come to mind are Deborah Lake's book, Secret Ceremonies, even Sonia Johnson's Housewife to Heretic, and of course Linda Sillitoe's Salamander. Even Terry Tempest Williams' recent book, Leap, engages some of these things. And these are the kinds of books where I'm seeing women, Mormon women, really start to engage this in a powerful way, the anger and the darkness. Another aspect I want to talk about is the redemptive aspect of this book. Above all, Riptide is a redemptive work. The main character, Laurel Greer, explores and confesses her inner feelings and reactions to the evil in life, her own anger, hatred, and the desire to destroy that which has destroyed her. In this way, she finds redemption by knowing and integrating her own dark side. She also finds redemption by speaking her own truth and light. For an author, exposing abuse and the truth of who you really are in the face of lies and confusion is cleansing and healing. It exorcises the darkness one has carried inside or all by themselves by sharing it and releasing it with others. She also performs redemptive work for abuse victims and even for the abuser himself. And I want to talk a little bit about that. For an abuse victim, a work like Refuge provides a vicarious outlet for a very private ordeal and burden. It provides a way to see it on a canvas outside of yourself and work with it there at some distance. This author vicariously shows victims how to find their own redemption. You can't live in Utah very long without hearing stories about sexual abuse. I began hearing them at BYU in 1980 from fellow students. It was a strange new reality, made even stranger by its commonality. People young and old and gay and straight and male and female told me their tales of abuse, much to my horror. In the words of one abuse survivor named Becky, who wasn't abused? I wasn't. I was one of the lucky ones. A girl child in a small LDS community in Idaho during the 1960s, playing carefree and safe, unharmed by those who watch and prey upon the innocent. But it is for those unlike me who were abused and who were damaged that I felt compelled to work with Marion and help bring information about abuse to light. I think that those who exist outside of the abuse dynamic can and should defend and aid those who have been abused. Still, I was unprepared for the depth and breadth of this problem, which seems to know no end. And that is its very nature, to have no boundaries. On the other hand, choosing limits gives some definition. Whether you are a victim or an abuser or a healer, at some point you decide when you've had enough. And that is the moment when healing begins. I want to talk about the redemptive nature of this book for an abuser now. Because I think that in the process of working out her own redemption in print, Marion Smith and Laurel Greer, really the main character in this book, they do the very thing that an abuser cannot do for himself, and that is confess the darkness within. By having the main character, Laurel Greer, take the reader through this process of self-reflection, self-review, confession of darkness and light, demons and angels within, Laurel Greer performs a redemptive act for her own abuser. An abuser cannot access his own darkness. He must keep it at a distance, buried deep in his subconscious or projected outside onto someone else. The very nature of damage is that you can't function normally. You cannot be what has been destroyed. If your calmness and stability have been destroyed, then you cannot be calm and stable. If your sexual boundaries are gone, then you have no sexual boundaries. And the very thing you cannot do is the very thing that you need. A damaged person can only transcend this dysfunction when he finally acquires that missing ability. And many people never do that, either because the damage is too deep or it is simply not humanly possible. Thus, an abuser does not have the luxury of confession. He does not have that ability because it would remove his only coping mechanism, which is denial. Without denial, he would collapse into truth. And truth would destroy who he is. Denial is his only protection from this destruction. And yet denial is also what keeps him from healing. It was after reading Brian Evanson's book, Father of Lies, that I understood why I could find some compassion for abusers. An abuser is a victim who is stuck in the cycle of abuse and cannot leave. Abusers need to displace the pain onto others, creating more victims, unable to exist without them. Meanwhile, Riptide poses a very difficult question for all of us. How does a writer or a parent or a priest or a lawyer or a judge or a society find a humane balance that forgives the sinner while still dealing with the sin? How do we address abuse and stop it without harming the victim or the abuser any more than they've already been harmed? Marion Smith finds no easy answers to this dilemma, yet she explores it fully, examining it from all sides. Through Laurel Greer, Smith is able to act in ways that one cannot act in real life. There's a quote in the book where Marion, I couldn't find it, but I'll just say it from memory, where Marion says, she's talking about truth and the church being true and all the truth that she's been taught to believe. And she realizes that truth is slippery, it's gone, it doesn't exist for her anymore because the truths that she once believed are no longer true based on the new reality she has encountered. And she says, what is truth? 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 I am tired to the bone of trying to find the truth. And I thought about this as I pulled my thoughts together today, and an answer came to me. That the truth is very simple. It's not something out there with a big capital T. It is simply the opposite of a lie. An abuser lies. He cannot tell the truth to himself. So he is two different people. And that itself is the lie, which sometimes grows big beyond himself, enveloping other people around him. Abuse is a lie that is inflicted upon you and then denied by the very one who did it. We cannot control what others do. We can only be true to ourselves and speak the truth of who we are. And this is the only way to diffuse the power of an abuser, I think, and his great lies that sometimes press in upon us. Be true to who you are and speak from your heart, no matter what he, the liar, does or says. That is all you have, but it is everything that he cannot do. The act of being in truth, in harmony with yourself, is the only defense against the lie. I believe truth comes to those who ask. I've been asking for the truth myself over the 7 years that I've worked with Marion and seen this beautiful manuscript come together. And I realized that for me, my truth is a different truth than the abuse victims. I was not abused as a child, but I did encounter abuse as an adult, as a woman at BYU. And it was devastating because I was so naive. Given the damage that I found as an adult, I cannot imagine surviving abuse as a child. And yet there are some in this room who have. I don't know how you did it, but I'm grateful that you did. For although you've lost the most that a person can lose, the very fact that you have makes you an example for me of how a human being who is destroyed can still survive. You are the experts. You are the ones who show us the way. Without your suffering, your loss, and your amazing effort toward redemption, I could not have healed myself. We do not walk this road alone. We have to have help from each other, pulling us back up out of the pit and standing with us as we speak our own truth in the face of a great lie and all of its power. So I thank you all, Marion Smith and Nick Smith, and all of you who have suffered abuse and survived. You are the shamans in this dark work. I thank you for showing me the way and helping me learn how to save my own soul.
Thank you for your attendance at this session. Due to the limitations of time, I would invite you to take your subject matter or questions or topics directly to our presenters today, Marion and Maxine, because this topic is something that is certainly timely. And I, like you, hopefully have gained something to be able to assist or understand or help somebody along the way through this arduous journey. Thank you for your attendance here today.